Good evening. My name is Paul Holdengraber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, otherwise known as Live from the New York Public Library. Initially, Slavoj Žižek and I thought that we would have a conversation with each other on stage, and we figured that if we did that, we didn't know who would outdo each other's accent. So we decided not to do it. You know, when people ask me where my accent is from, I simply tell them it's affected. It's a great pleasure to welcome you tonight to what I think will be a lecture, perhaps, and certainly a performance. I won't say very much more because Slavoj Žižek will be coming in a few minutes. I would like to thank 192 Books for selling the books, both of Slavoj Žižek and the current issue of The Believer. I highly recommend you pick that up too, because it has a video of the guide, the pervert guide to cinema by Slavoj Žižek. I think you might enjoy it. I would also like to thank Metro, who is our sponsor for all things print. I would also like to tell you about upcoming events, particularly an event about James Baldwin. It's a tribute we're doing to James Baldwin, and it's happening next Tuesday. We sold out of the small space, South Court, with 200 people, and just opened it up, and I highly recommend that if you're interested, you sign up as quickly as possible. It will have Colm Toybean, John Edgar Wideman, Mantia Diawara, Farah Jasmine Griffin, Michael Thelwell, and the moderator will be Walton Muyumba. I just discovered, I must admit, the work of James Baldwin, and I am just deeply moved. And so I feel that I want to share this joy with you, so please come. Now, some of you may not know the other kinds of events we have coming up, so I recommend you join our email list. There you'll see not only are we doing a Baldwin event, but we are finishing the season with a celebration of Ian Fleming, who will celebrate, if he were to be alive today, 100 years of existence. And we will be doing a Bond event. And I don't yet quite know who's coming, but I think it might be quite fun. And I know that Slavoj Žižek has a take on Bond, and he might digress on that in a few minutes. Now, many of you might wonder who Slavoj Žižek is, since very few of you have come today. And I just wanted to let you know who he is. So I asked Žižek to write, I'm sorry, I'm turning my back to you. I asked Žižek to write a Žižek by Žižek. I don't know if any of you read this, but it gives you a sense of the man. Slavoj Žižek, philosopher and psychoanalyst, with three basic orientations, a Hegelian in philosophy, a Lacanian in psychoanalysis, a Christian materialist in religion, and a communist in politics. Arguably the only living philosopher who uses positively the terms dialectic materialism and dictatorship of the proletariat. His work triggers continuous controversy. Welcome to the Desert of the Real, he analyzes the 9/11 event, how was attacked on anti-Semitic, was attacked as an anti-Semitic in Israel and a Zionist in Egypt. In his numerous books, he always returns to Hollywood. Good cinema is, for Žižek, a school of critical dialectics for the uneducated masses. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce my Marxist friend to you, Slavoj Žižek.
We often find references to psychoanalysis embodied in the very relations between persons. For example, the three Marx brothers, Groucho, Chico, Harpo. It's clear, Groucho, the most popular one, with his nervous hyperactivity is superego.
Well, that covers a lot of ground. Say, you cover a lot of ground yourself. You better beat it. I hear they're going to tear you down and put up an office building where you're standing. You can leave in a taxi. If you can't get a taxi, you can leave in a huff. If that's too soon, you can leave in a minute and a half. You know you haven't stopped talking since I came here?
Chico, the rational guy, egotistic, calculating all the time, is ego.
Chicolini, you're charged with high treason. And if found guilty, you'll be shot.
I object.
Oh, you object. On what grounds? I couldn't think of anything else to say.
Objection sustained.
And the weirdest of them all, Harpo, the mute guy, he doesn't talk. Freud said that drives are silent. He doesn't talk. He, of course, is id.
Who are you guys? What are you doing in my room?
He's my partner, but he not speak. He's demoned off.
The id in all its radical ambiguity. Namely, what is so weird about the Harpo character is that he's childishly innocent, just striving for pleasure, likes children, plays with children, and so on. But at the same time, possessed by some kind of primordial evil, aggressive all the time. And this unique combination of utter corruption and innocence is what the id is about. Thank you very much for coming here, although this was for me a slight embarrassment. Like whenever I see myself on screen like this, I try to avoid it. My first automatic reaction is to ask you, would you allow a guy like that take your daughter to cinema? No, the answer is obvious, no? No, seriously, I want to thank Paul. I always like to be here in the movie, not a big success, but an interesting one, I think, Roland Emmerich's, you remember, The Day After Tomorrow. I think this building was practically the only one in the New York City where people survived the big freeze. I think it's the correct thesis. New York Public Library is, for me, a wonderful mixture of what I cannot but call spiritual obscenity. So, I like to be here. Since I have, as usual, many things to say, let me go directly to the point. And if you are religious, pray that all this technical stuff with clips will function. So let me begin. Ideology in cinema. It sounds either an old-fashioned, traditional Marxist question, or rather stupid, irrelevant one. But I think it is still relevant. Where are we to look for it? I think not in a film's big topic, but in an apparently marginal narrative feature which, as it were, provides the frame for the big event. Think about the production of a couple motive which frames a typical Hollywood narrative about a big historical event, war, natural catastrophe, or whatever. This motif is quite literally the film's ideological surplus enjoyment. Although we directly enjoy the spectacular shots of the catastrophe, war battles, the gigantic wave which destroys cities, Titanic sinking, or whatever, the surplus enjoyment is provided by the sub-narrative of the couple. It is this frame, as the frame through which we perceive the spectacular events, this frame is the film's surplus enjoyment, that which, as it were, bribes us libidinally to accept the ideology of the story. Now, I would like to begin now with a variation on this same motif, namely the deadlock, impasse of the paternal authority, and then its restoration. I think, for example, this is a motif which secretly runs through practically all Steven Spielberg's films, E.T., Empire of the Sun, Jurassic Park, up to Schindler's List and War of the Worlds. I think they're basically all variations on the same motif. Let me begin with E.T. The crucial detail to note from the very beginning is that the family, and the family of the small boy to whom E.T. appears, the family was deserted by the father, as we learn at the very beginning. So that E.T. is ultimately a kind of a vanishing mediator who provides a new father. You remember at the film's end, when E.T. finally goes home. There is already the only good scientist who in the film's last shots is already seen standing by the mother as a future partner. So I think that you shouldn't be too fascinated by E.T. and all that crap. It's really a story about reappearance of the father. Now, Dave, please, if we can now, I pray that it will work, see the two clips.
Maybe an elf or a leprechaun.
There's nothing like that, penis breath!
Elliot! Sit down.
Dad would believe me.
Maybe you ought to call your father and tell him about it.
I can't. He's in Mexico with Sally.
Where's Mexico?
If you ever see it again, whatever it is, don't touch it, just...
Paternal figure, played by Sam Neill, jokingly threatening a kid with a dinosaur bone. This bone is clearly the tiny object, a version of what Winnicott called the transitional object which later explodes into gigantic dinosaurs. So that, I'm tempted to say that within the film's phantasmatic universe, the dinosaur's destructive fury only materializes the rage of the paternal superego, which is why later, in the middle of the film, the pursuit group of paternal figure Sam Neill with the two kids, they take refuge from the murderous carnivorous dinosaurs on a gigantic tree. When they do this, significantly, the dinosaurs which approach them there turn out to be the benevolent herbivorous kind. That tired, then they fall asleep, and the paternal figure, the Neil character, throws away the dinosaur bone that was stuck into his belt, signaling that he is now reconciled with the children, displaying warm affection and care for them. It's again, what's crucial is this move from bad father who rejects children to good father taking care. Please, the two clips from Jurassic Park.
Cretaceous period. You get your first look at this 6-foot turkey as you enter a clearing. He moves like a bird, lightly bobbing his head. And you keep still because you think that maybe his visual acuity is based on movement like T-Rex. And he'll lose you if you don't move. But no, not Velociraptor. You stare at him. And he just stares right back. And that's when the attack comes. Not from the front, but from the side. From the other two raptors, you didn't even know were there. Because Velociraptor's a pack hunter, you see. He uses coordinated attack patterns. And he is out in force today. And he slashes at you with this. 6-inch retractable claw, like a razor, on the middle toe. He doesn't bother to bite your jugular like a lion, say. No, no. He slashes at you here, or here.
Oh, well.
Or maybe across the belly, spilling your intestines. The point is, you are alive when they start to eat you.
Make an exception.
Well, I hate the other kind.
kind just do what they do.
You don't have to pick up dinosaur bones anymore.
I don't know, I guess. Guess we'll just have to evolve, too.
What do you call a blind dinosaur?
I don't know. What do you call a blind dinosaur?
Do you think he saw us? What do you call a blind dinosaur's dog?
You got me.
Or do you think he saw us, Rex? What if the dinosaurs come back while we're all asleep?
Well, I'll stay awake.
All night?
All night.
Different perspectives. On the one hand, it's the fascinating story about the dinosaurs. On the other hand, the true frame is this story of reasserting paternal authority. And I claim that if we go on, even Schindler's List is, at its most basic level, a remake of Jurassic Park, with the Nazis as the dinosaur monsters, Schindler as the film's, at the beginning, cynical profiteering, opportunistic paternal figure, and the ghetto Jews as threatened children. I mean, their infantilization in the film is, for me, eye-striking. So the story really tells, the film really tells the story about Schindler's gradual rediscovery of his paternal duty towards the Jews, of his transformation into a caring, respectable father figure. And even The War of the Worlds, is it not the last installment of this saga? Tom Cruise, as you know, plays a divorced working-class father who neglects his two children. The invasion of the aliens reawakens in him the proper paternal instincts, and he rediscovers himself as a caring father. In the last scene, he finally gets the recognition from his son, who, throughout the film, despises him. So in the mode of the 19th century novels, which had an explanatory subtitle, The Story of a Young Gentleman, and so on. The film War of the Worlds could also have been subtitled A Story of How a Working Class Father Finally Gets Reconciled with His Son. No wonder, then, that the same key discloses the underlying ideology of the greatest cinema hit of them all, James Cameron's Titanic. Namely, is Titanic really a film about the catastrophe of the ship which hits the iceberg? I claim that beneath the story of a love couple, Titanic tells another story, the story of a spoiled high society girl in what we call an identity crisis. She's confused, doesn't know what to do with herself, and much more than her love partner, Jack, played by DiCaprio, is a kind of, again, vanishing mediator whose function is to restore her sense of identity and purpose in life, to restore her self-image. Quite literally, he draws her image. Once his job is done, he can disappear. So please, the first clip for Titanic, from Titanic.
My heart was pounding the whole time. It was the most erotic moment of my life. up until then, at least.
So what happened next?
You mean, did we do it? Sorry to disappoint you, Mr. Bodine. Jack was very professional.
Doing?
Will you put this back in the safe for me?
Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
Okay. Now, of course, there is the love story, but even there, we should be very attentive how to read it. Namely, we should be attentive to the precise moment of the catastrophe. When does the ship hit the iceberg? The catastrophe takes place when the two lovers, Leonardo DiCaprio, Kate Winslet, immediately after consummating their link in the sexual act, return to the ship's deck. This, however, is not all. If this were all, then the catastrophe would have been simply the punishment of fate for the double transgression, illegitimate sexual act, crossing class divisions. What is more crucial is that, on the deck, Kate passionately says to her lover that when she decided, when the ship will reach New York the next morning, she will live with him, preferring poor life with her true love to the false, corrupted life among the rich. At this exact moment, the ship hits the iceberg. Please, let's go on.
Look at this.
Oh, look at that, would ya?
Better put a woman a wheel.
Well, if that's what it takes for us to get warm, I'd rather not, if it's all the same of you, all right?
You bastards!
Is there anyone there?
Yes, what do you see?
Iceberg right ahead!
Thank you.
Iceberg right ahead!
On the starboard!
I think, what's the underlying logic here? My solution is very simple. Why does the ship hit the iceberg? In order to prevent what would have been the true catastrophe, the couple's life in New York. One can safely guess that the misery of everyday life would destroy their love. So the catastrophe occurs in order to save their love, in order to sustain the illusion that if it were not to happen, they would have lived happily forever after. You know, it's the same as, let me give you an association, a similar example, I am saying this as a leftist, from politics. If you are old enough, you remember how we were all crushed and sad, Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact forces in 68 invading Czechoslovakia. I'm more and more convinced it was a blessing in disguise. Because imagine the Soviet army would not invade Czechoslovakia. What would have happened? Sooner, I don't think there was really a chance of building a truly democratic socialism, whatever. Sooner or later, this liberal communist, Dubček and company in power, would have confronted the true choice. Either they simply joined the West or slowly reassert communist power. So I claim that it's the very Soviet intervention, and I'm not saying they did it for this reason. I'm not celebrating them. What I'm saying is that their very intervention, in a way, saved the illusion. Oh, what a chance this was for truly democratic socialism. They were the iceberg hitting the Czechoslovakia there. But let's now go to the central scene of the film, which is so weird, or at least has a tiny weird feature which people even usually I noticed don't note it. Remember the final moments of DiCaprio. He's freezing in the cold water, dying, while Kate Winslet is safely floating on a large piece of wood. Then, when she becomes aware that he is dead, listen to this detail. See it and listen to it carefully. She, yeah, please. Cameron's superficial so-called Hollywood Marxism, you remember, his all too obvious privileging of the lower classes and his caricatural depiction of the cruel egotism and of opportunism of the rich, should not deceive us. Beneath this sympathy for the poor, there is another narrative, the profoundly reactionary myth, first fully deployed, as far as I know, by Rudyard Kipling's Captain's Courageous, of a young rich person in crisis who gets his or her vitality restored by a brief intimate contact with the full-blooded life of the poor. What lurks behind the compassion for the poor is their vampiristic exploitation. So I think, again, that, you know, beneath this surface of sympathy for the poor, love, there is another story told. Pretty reactionary. Now, the ridiculous climax of this Hollywood procedure of staging great historical events as the background of the formation of a couple is Warren Beatty's Rats, in which Hollywood found a way to rehabilitate the October Revolution itself, the most traumatic historical event of the 20th century. You know, in the key development in the center of the film, the couple of John Reed and Louise Bryant, Warren Beatty and Diane Keaton, are in what we call an emotional relationship crisis. Their love is then reignited when Louise watches John delivering an impassionate revolutionary speech. What then follows is their love-making intersected with the archetypal scenes from the revolution, some of which reverberate in an all too obvious way with the lovemaking. Say, when John penetrates Louise, there is a cut onto a street where a dark crowd of demonstrating people envelops and stops a penetrating phallic tramway, and so on. All this against the background of singing The International. So when at the orgasmic climax, Lenin himself appears addressing a packed hall of delegates, he is more a wise teacher overseeing leading the couple's love initiation than a cold revolutionary reader. So even the October Revolution is okay if it serves to reconnect the couple. So you will see at the end of this clip, you even have a Christmas tree. It's the happy American couple. It's reconstituted. Please. see, that's how you do it in Hollywood. Anything goes, October Revolution and so on, plus the couple with Christmas tree should be reconstituted. Now you will say, okay, but why only Hollywood? What about other cultures? So, okay, let me take a look at the successors of the October Revolution itself. Let me look at what is the ultimate Stalinist war epic. Ciuarelli's famous, or rather infamous, The Fall of Berlin from 1948, the supreme case of the Stalinist war epics, the story of the Soviet victory over Hitler's Germany. And if you wonder about how Stalin appears in the film, you should bear in mind always that Stalin, as it is proven today, co-wrote those lines. The film begins, it's really, that's my, how do they call it in Perry Mason novels, you know, the big case for the prosecution or what? The film begins in 1941, just prior to the German invasion of the Soviet Union. The hero, a Stakhanovit model steelworker, is in love with the local teacher, but too shy to directly approach her. He is then awarded the Stalin Prize and received by Stalin in his dacha, Stalin's dacha. We will see this, unfortunately, in a scene which was cut out after 1953 and then lost, because in that scene also Beria appears. Beria was, after 53, a non-person. This is a tragedy. What you see, I have the scenario, I know, I got it from my friends in Moscow. In this scene, after the official congratulations, Stalin notices a kind of nervous uneasiness in the hero and asks him what is wrong. The hero confesses to Stalin his love problems, and Stalin advises him on how to win the girl's heart, which Pushkin verses recite to her and so on. Of course, my God, if you got advice from Stalin, it cannot fail. So, back home, the hero succeeds in seducing the girl. However, at the very moment when he is carrying her in his arms into the grass, obviously to do it, something happens. As you will see, the bombs from German planes start to fall all around. It is June 22nd, 41. It's an incredibly how, you know, the same as in Titanic. Here, the iceberg is how exactly, you should be always attentive, I claim, in Hollywood, or in Soviet Hollywood, when a catastrophe occurs, at what precise moment it occurs. So, listen to the, in the first shot that you will see, be careful, attentive to the music, listen and behave. They no longer make such films today, please. The Fall of Berlin, yeah. It's not just panorama, you assume, you got the guy there.
Товарищ Сталин, Столивар Иванов явился по вашему вызову.
Простите.
Вы не знаете, зачем меня вызвали, а? Может, можно не идти туда? Ей-богу, я не могу. Отпустите вы меня, ради бога. Ну что я, рапортовать надо или как? Ну лучше Хмельницкого вызову.
Вот, товарищ Сталин.
Здравствуйте.
Здравствуйте, Семен Иванович.
Простите, ради бога.
Это моего отца звали так. А я Иосиф Виссарионович.
Я знаю, товарищ Сталин.
Пойдемте.
Now it's the Khrushchev censorship. And now he is back and Note the wonderful theatrical ridicule of this short love scene.
А я тебя так ждала, Алёша. Не знаю почему. Не спала все ночи.
А ты знаешь, я Сталину рассказал о том, как люблю тебя.
Ты с ума сошел.
Ну а что?
Ой. А он что?
Ничего, говорит, не пугайте стихов. Любите ее, и она вас любить будет.
Выдумываешь ты все. Ни за что не поверю.
Ей-богу, вот так и сказал. А если, говорит, она вас любить не будет, вот тогда мне напишите.
Алешенька. Алешенька, я тебя очень люблю. Я тебя так люблю, что мне кажется, жизнь моя и вообще всех-всех людей стала втрое лучше и дороже. С тех пор, как я полюбила тебя.
I want to kiss you, but watch it now, she says.
Алёша! Алексей!
Наташка! Иди сюда!
Смотри, Алёша! Алёша, что это?
Наташа! Наташа!
Алёша, Алёша, Нина, что же это?
Okay. Stop,
please. I have to explain it. Now then, in the ensuing confusion, the girl is taken prisoner by the Germans, taken to a working camp near Berlin, while the hero joins the Red Army, fighting in the first lines to get back to his love. Now, at the film's end, when the jubilant crowd of camp prisoners liberated by the Red Army mingles with the Russian soldiers, a plane lands on an open field nearby. Stalin himself steps out and walks towards the crowd, which greets him passionately. At that very point, as if again mediated by Stalin's presence, the love couple, they recognize each other in the crowd, and the love couple is reunited. The girl takes note of the hero in the crowd, but nonetheless, she, after greeting him, approaches Stalin and asks him if she can give him a kiss. Wonderful scene. Please watch it. Please.
Сегодня мы празднуем великую победу над германским фашизмом. Дорогой ценой приобретена эта победа. Не забывайте принесенных вами жертв. Отныне история открывает перед народом, любящим свободу, широкий путь. Каждый народ должен бороться за мир во всем мире, за счастье простых людей, всех стран, всех народов. Только тогда можно будет сказать, что наши жертвы не пропали даром, что каждый из нас сможет твердо смотреть в свое будущее. Будем же беречь мир во имя будущего.
Okay, stop. Okay. So truly, again, they no longer make films like this today. But again, did you notice how The Fall of Berlin is effectively the story of a couple reunited? The World War II serves as the obstacle to be overcome so that the hero can reach his love, like the dragon the knight has to kill to get to the princess imprisoned in a castle. The role of Stalin, again, is that of a magician and matchmaker who wisely leads the couple to their reunion. Another thing to be analyzed in a closer, more refined approach is, did you notice something that a very precise economy that the two scenes share? That's beneath this ridicule. How they, in the first scene in the field, they, the girl and the her, okay, future husband, lover, embrace, but it is as if there must be an outburst of passion, but which must be staged. It's other, no, we have to go apart so that then, oh, you are, and so on. And it's the same at the end. Basically, they see each other, but it is as if they need their time to organize the passion, you know. She looks a little bit, and then, oh, Alyosha, are you there? It's a very strange temporality where not official speech, but passion is basically presented as something that ultimately has to be organized and staged and so on. Okay, just the last example from this comical series, then we go, unfortunately, to more serious stuff. I think the same interpretive key fits also science fiction catastrophe films. In Mimi Leder's Deep Impact, a gigantic comet which is threatening to hit the Earth also creates a couple, although an unexpected one. The incestuous couple of the young, obviously neurotic, sexually inactive TV reporter and her promiscuous father, who has divorced her mother and just married a younger woman. The film is effectively a drama about this unresolved incestuous father-daughter relationship. The threatening comet obviously gives body to the self-destructive rage of the heroine. So the entire machinery of global catastrophe is set in motion so that the father's young wife will abandon him and the father will return not to his wife, but to her daughter. The culmination of the film is the scene in which the heroine rejoins her father who, alone on a beach, awaits the impending wave. And my thesis is that this scene is to be read against the background of the standard Hollywood motif, rendered famous for example, in Fred Zinnemann's From Here to Eternity, of a couple making love on the beach, brushed by gently, softly by waves. You know, Burt Lancaster and Deborah Kerr. Here, the couple is the truly deadly, incestuous one. Enough of fun, let's move towards slightly more serious waters. First, an interesting thing to note is how even high art cinema is not free of such ideological framing. Let me take a well-known serious film, Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris, and compare it with Stanislav Lem's classic science fiction novel, also Solaris, on which it is based. Solaris is a planet with an oceanic fluid surface which moves incessantly and from time to time imitates recognizable forms. Soon after his arrival to a spaceship above the planet Solaris, Kelvin, the hero, finds at his side, in his bed, his dead wife, Harry, who years ago on Earth killed herself after he abandoned her. Kelvin finally understands that Harry is a materialization of his own innermost traumatic fantasies. Solaris is a gigantic brain which directly materializes our innermost fantasies. So Tarkovsky's Solaris is really about the hero's inner journey, about his attempt to come to terms with his past sins, with his repressed truth. Basically, it's the same as Dinosaurs and so on. It's really a story of a man coming to terms with his mistakes in his love life, and the planet is just a pretext, but not in the novel. Stanislav Lem's novel, which is much better, I think, focuses on this inert presence of the planet, of this thing which thinks. The point of the novel is precisely that Solaris remains an impenetrable other with no possible communication to it. True, it returns our innermost fantasies, but it remains through totally impenetrable. Why does it do it? Is it a purely mechanical response? Does it play demonic games with us? Does it do it to help us or whatever? It would thus be interesting to put Tarkovsky in the series of Hollywood commercial rewritings of novels which have served as the base for a movie. Tarkovsky does exactly the same to the novel as the lowest Hollywood producer would have done it, reinscribing the enigmatic encounter with an impenetrable otherness into the framework of the production of the couple. It's interesting to note this. However, Tarkovsky, as a true artist, also shows the way out of this ideological deadlock. There is a famous scene in his Mirror in which the heroine, who works as a proofreader for a daily newspaper in the Soviet Union of the mid-1930s, runs in rain from her home to the printing office and then runs there along the corridors looking desperately for where are the proofs of, because there is a suspicion that she missed an obscene misprint of Stalin's name. Tarkovsky incidentally refers here to a well-known legend according to which in the time of the darkest purges an issue of Pravda was almost printed in which Stalin's name was misspelled Sralin. Srat means to shit. Not a good thing to do in the mid-30s. Okay, then that's all the narrative event. Just she runs there and finally relief discovers that the mistake was corrected. But here is Sean Martin's nice comment on this scene. I quote, "It is as if Tarkovsky were content just to watch Margarita Terekova, the actress, running through the rain, down steps, across yards, into corridors. Here, Tarkovsky reveals the presence of beauty in something that is apparently mundane and paradoxically, given the period, also potentially fatal for Maria, the heroine, if the mistake she thinks she had made has gone to press. Please."
Куда это вы так спешите?
Okay. Can you put the sound a little bit lower, please? So that, unfortunately, it's obscene what I'm doing now, but that's the sound a little bit lower. So, the effect of beauty is generated precisely by the excessive length of the scene. You never just watch Maria running and immersed into the narrative, worrying if she will arrive on time to prevent the catastrophe. We are seduced into looking at the scene, taking note of its phenomenal nature, the intensity of movement, the dilapidated, crumbling, but nonetheless, in a strange way, attractive background, and so on. So that's, I think, the first move to do, what Gilles Deleuze called from movement image to time image. When things go slow, you suddenly, as it were, notice the background. I think it's a beautiful procedure. And I think, okay, so let's simply go on, leave it to the end, please. And then, please, let it go on with the next clip, which is from the Chinese film Still Life. Let's just enjoy this as a background.
Надо посмотреть в шкафу, в набор.
So,
конечно, вы же сами их туда положили.
Это же не беда, Маша. My next example will be, I think, a beautiful Chinese film. I'm not sure I will pronounce the director's name correctly.
Но ведь это же такое издание.
Я Жан Кес.
Ой, это же такое издание.
Which really can be said to reinvent Rossellini and Antonioni in a Chinese.
Любое издание должно быть без опечаток.
It provides Chinese non-Hollywood
piece
to the production of the couple. The irony is that the beauty of the three gorgeous dams is gigantic. There are in the film two individual stories which are set against this background.
Что-нибудь случилось?
Да нет, ничего страшного. Нет, ничего страшного, конечно, нет. Я просто хочу посмотреть, может быть, я ошибаюсь. Нет, то есть я не ошиблась.
Вот именно, Маш, давай все по порядку.
Нет, я лучше сама, я лучше одна посмотрю.
В бой все сложно, все спешат, всем нет.
Идеологически резонирует в general background контекст. More generally, the whole of still life is characterized by the properly dialectical tension between form and content, a tension which brings to mind not so much Rossellini and Antonioni, as rather Robert Altman, who is, I think, one of the few true great masters of American cinema. For example, Altman's Shortcuts. Altman's universe, again, best rendered by Shortcuts, is that of contingent encounters between a multitude of series, parallel destinies, a universe in which different series communicate and resonate at the level of what Altman himself refers to as subliminal reality, meaningless mechanical shocks, encounters, impersonal intensities which precede the level of social meaning. We are still with a mirror, I think. Okay, it's a background. What this means is that one should avoid the temptation, the usual leftist temptation, of reducing Altman to a poet of American alienation, rendering the silent despair of everyday life in the upper middle class suburbia and so on. There is another, much more optimistic Altman, the one of opening oneself to joyful contingent encounters. I think one should do to Altman what Deleuze and Guattari proposed to do to Kafka. We shouldn't be deceived by this Kafkaesque obsession with this bureaucracy, absent God, search for meaning, and so on. Look, it's this big background absence which blinds us for the joyful present, small object things like Kundera, whom I otherwise, Milan Kundera, the Czech writer, don't appreciate so much, had a wonderful line. He wrote somewhere that for this metaphysically obsessed Western people, Kafka is the poet of alienation, absent God, but that for many Czechs, I hope this is true what he said, Kafka is a poet of, it's like comical children's fairy tales. Isn't it funny? You go to sleep, you awaken as a giant insect or whatever. I mean, okay, it's not exactly to laugh. But the point is that if there is a Kafkaesque despair, it is nonetheless rooted in this experience. Kafka is a profoundly comical author, which, again, in no way cancels his existential anxieties and so on. He should rather, I think, be read at the same level as, for example, the fact that all good films about Holocaust are comedies, not because it was easy. Like, we can laugh at it, but this is my old topic that I like to emphasize. When things get really horrible, you can no longer make a tragedy. It's an obscenity to make a tragedy. If you make a standard tragedy, imagine in Auschwitz an evil Nazi officer confronting a Jew or gypsy or a prisoner there, and the prisoner proudly stands up, no, rather give my life, and so on. It's ridiculous. It gives too much dignity to the Nazis. You were too humiliated there to play this heroic role. And now we are at the other background, this one. So again, I think it's the same thing. That's what provides the true wealth, richness, and artistic excellence of Altman's universe, I think. It's not this, it's not really about all this alienation of American couple. You should read it against the background of this much more refined texture of the film. It's totally different ontology. And this is what accounts, this accounts for the tension. I'm sorry, I don't have time because I usually talk too long. I even wanted to make at this point a kind of a musical excursion and propose to read against this background as an example of communism in music, Eric Satie, you know, all those gymnopédies and so on. It may sound strange, like usually we associate with communism in music what we heard there, no, these bombastic cantatas, oratorios for the heroism of the working class and so on. But it's much more complex. Do you know, I was shocked to learn that in the last years of his life, Satie was not only a member of the French Communist Party, but a member of the Central Committee. Do you know, for example, that another French composer who also usually stands for this kind of reserved French bourgeois attitude, Maurice Ravel, that he, for example, in 24, he rejected membership in Académie Française out of protest of how France is treating Soviet Union. He was also the first to set to music some anti-colonialist African popular protest songs and so on. So my idea is that what you find, you know that Satie characterized his music as musique d'ameublement, furniture music. His whole point was that it should function as background, as rendering background palpable, which is why to associate Satie with somebody who is undoubtedly closer to you. Do you know that John Cage was a great, great admirer of Satie because of this? So, again, that's my subversive communist seduction, you know. Be aware when you listen to Satie, you are already under the spell of communist propaganda or what. Okay, but let me go on. So, again, I think that the same as what I... Now I finally caught it up. The same as what I said for Altman also holds for still life. Even this obvious desolation, depression engendered by the film's content shouldn't deceive us. The underlying mood of the film, rendered by its formal texture, is the one of melancholic beauty, affirmation of life. This is what I think, a true art, true new domain of art in cinema, which is why, for example, I was fascinated when David Lynch, who does, I think, unfortunately, many crazy things, all that meditation stuff and so on, that he fell in love with the city of Lodz, I think, in Poland, and he was fascinated by this Tarkovskian countryside of industrial building falling apart, being recaptured by nature. Walter Benjamin had somewhere a wonderful line. He says that we only get a true sense of history when we see historical objects, monuments, half abandoned, recaptured by nature. I think this is, here I see an option for truly great cinema today. To conclude, I wanted to do two Hollywood neglected masterpieces. I think it's better to skip the first one. So please, Dave, when this one is over, go directly to the clips from John Carpenter's They Live. I wanted to begin with John Frankenheimer's Seconds, which is, I think, an incredible neglected masterpiece. We don't have time, so I go to John Carpenter's They Live from 1988. Again, I think the neglected masterpiece maybe of the Hollywood left. It's a true lesson in critique of ideology, in how even in Hollywood you can do some works against it. You can undermine it. It is, they leave, the story of John Nada. Nice irony, it's Nada is Spanish for nothing. A proletarian position, as it were. A homeless laborer who finds work on a Los Angeles construction site. One of the workers, Frank Armitage, there takes him to spend night at a local shantytown. While being shown around that night, Nada notices some odd behavior at a small church across the street. Investigating it next day, he accidentally stumbles on several more boxes hidden in a secret compartment in a wall full of sunglasses. When he later puts on a pair of these mysterious sunglasses, what happens? Well, wait a second. Let's have a little bit of background. I mean, this is still the very end of still life. No, really, what I admire in this film is that it resists the obvious temptation of this wild dissident attack on the Three Gorges Dam, precisely by keeping this devastation, ecological devastation, gently in the background. It does a much more effective job of critique. I mean, everything is here. It shows the... Oh, here we are. Perfect. Let's go on. What happens when you put glasses on?
What's your problem? I said, what's your problem?
How are you today, sir?
Okay, how's it going?
Fine, thank you. Thank you, sir. Here you are, sir. Thank you. Hey, buddy. You gonna pay for that or what? Look, buddy. I don't want no house today. Either pay for it or put it back.
Okay, as you saw, he then discovers that there are aliens among us, controlling us, and so on and so on. Now, then, Nada escapes and returns to the construction site to talk over what he has discovered with his friend Armitage. And then comes one of the other key sequence of the film. There is something so obvious going there, so obviously strange that we don't even usually notice it. Nada wants his friend to put on the glasses so that he will see reality, and the friend resists. And it's a totally irrational scene, legendary, maybe known to some of you, going on for over 10 minutes. It's totally irrational, but I think deeply convincing. Why? So please, Dave, let's go on with the second scene.
The best I can do.
You know, he always wants to convince himself if the other guy is human.
You better find yourself someplace to hide and keep praying nobody ever finds you.
Dave, can you please put voice a little bit lower, because this will go on for the 10 minutes for my final reflections, as it were. Then you will see in the final battle, after destroying the broadcasting antenna by means of which the aliens controlled us, Nada is mortally wounded. As his last dying act, he gives the aliens the finger. With the signal now missing, people suddenly see the aliens in their midst. So first, let me develop a little bit about this beautifully naive mise-en-scene of ideology. Through the critico-ideological glasses, we directly see what in my psychoanalytic jargon I would have called the master signifier beneath the chain of knowledge. We learn to see dictatorship in democracy. There is, of course, a naive aspect in this staging, reminding us of the not-so-well-known fact that some friends told me this. In the 1960s, the leadership of the Communist Party of the United States, in order to account for its failure to mobilize workers, seriously entertained the idea that the U.S. population is already controlled by some secretly distributed drugs in air, in water supply, and so on. But I think we do not need aliens or secret drugs or gases or whatever. The form of ideology does the work without them. It is because of this form that the depicted scene nonetheless stages our truth. Look at the front page of our daily newspapers. Every title, even and especially when it pretends just to inform us, contains an implicit injunction. So when you are asked to choose between liberal democracy and fundamentalism, it is not only that one term is obviously preferred. What is more important, the true injunction is to see this as the true choice, to ignore third options. So again, naive as it may seem, the film's staging of ideology is nonetheless more complex than it may appear. Once you put the glasses on and see it, it no longer determines you, which means that before you see it through the glasses, you also saw it, but you were not aware of it. I use here a joke that I'm almost ashamed to tell the story again. I use it so often, but nonetheless, I will do it briefly. You know, my joke with Donald Rumsfeld ontology, known knowns, unknown knowns, and so on. Literally, through these glasses, you see the unknown knowns, things that you don't know that you know, but nonetheless, you read them, they determine you. There is a further feature which makes this scene of putting on the glasses contemporary. In it, the ideological injunction is hidden so that it can only be directly seen through the glasses. Such a relationship between visible and invisible is predominant in our so-called postmodern, non-authoritarian consumerist societies, in which we subjects are no longer addressed on behalf of some big ideological identity, but we are simply addressed as subjects of pleasure. Today's ideology doesn't tell us sacrifice yourself for your country. The dominant message is realize yourself, enjoy life, make the best of it, and so on and so on. The master's injunction is hidden. But this is not how traditional ideology works. In the traditional, more traditional ideology, it is almost an inverse relationship. The explicit text addresses us as followers of some big cause, while the implicit message delivered between the lines concerns the obscene surplus enjoyment with which we are bribed if we subject ourselves to the cause. Like, for example, become a good fascist. Let's imagine a fascist poster. Do your duty towards your country, defend it against Jewish communist plot, become a fascist. Then you put on the same glasses and you can read. Okay, and you can read. And you can steal from the Jews, beat and lynch them, and so on and so on. Become a good Catholic priest, serve God. You put on the glasses, you can read, and you can play with the young boy as a dessert for it. Or get properly married, you put on the glasses, and an occasional discreet affair is tolerated. So we can imagine, for more traditional ideology, again, the opposite ideological glasses, where what you read is not the explicit order, as here, underlying the appearance of hedonist freedom, but on the contrary, you read the obscene, invisible, obscene underground. And I think we can go pretty far into how this works today. For example, imagine a scene of starving children in Africa with a call to do something, help them. You know, like, are you aware? Or, you know, all this stuff, which I think is absolute manipulation. Not that it's not true, but the ideology inscribed into it. Like, are you... Sorry, stop. Stop. Stop, please. Okay. For every word that I spoke here, hundred children died of malnutrition in Africa. This black... It sounds so humanistic, but I think if you put the ideological glasses on, the true message of this alertness, do something, people are starving, is don't think, don't politicize, forget about the true causes of their poverty. Just act, contribute money so that you will not have to think. I think this is the true message. I think, again, that this emergency state rhetoric, we in the States are living in ivory tower and so on, it's already appropriated by those in power. Then there is the scene you've just seen, the long fight between Nada and Armitage, worthy of Fight Club, another, I think, masterpiece of the Hollywood left. As you saw, it starts with Nada saying to Armitage, I'm giving you a choice. Either put on these glasses or start to eat that trash. The fight, as you noticed, is taking place among overturned trash bins. Then the fight went on, you saw, for unbearable 10 minutes. And it's a very strange fight. There are moments of exchanges, of friendly smiles, and it's in itself totally irrational. Why doesn't Armitage accept to put the glasses on? Just to satisfy his friend. The only explanation is that he knows that his friend wants to see him something dangerous, to attain a prohibited knowledge which would totally spoil the relative peace of his daily life. The violence staged here is this violence of two of them fighting, is a positive violence, a condition of liberation. The lesson is that our liberation from ideology is not a spontaneous act, an act of discovering our true self. And that's what I find convincing in this simple scene. Just think how it totally turns around the usual New Age idea of critique of ideology, which would be in everyday life we have ideological glasses. Learn to put down, take off the glasses and see with your own eyes reality the way it is. No, unfortunately, it doesn't work like this. Liberation hurts. You have to be forced to put your glasses on. The problem is that, again, we are naturally in ideology. Our natural immediate sight is ideological. It is thus quite appropriate that the final gesture of the dying hero, as I already hinted at, is the one of up yours, the finger. And then you will see, because that antenna which emits the rays by means of which aliens control us is explodes, people start to see. You will see a couple of comical scenes where people simply see who are the aliens among themselves. And I didn't do it on purpose, but in the very last scene, by mistake, I cut it too short. You will see a prostitute on the top of a customer, no? And then you see, but it's a poetic truth that the scene will be cut short, because in the film you see this kind of a zombie-like alien, no? Now you can see your governor, whatever, I don't know. Let's see this very short scene, please.
Give a press conference and how to buy a sailboat
where
as
prime minister. Like shit.
I'm on it.
What happened?
What's wrong?
All the sex and violence on the screen has gone too far for me. I'm fed up with it. Filmmakers like George Romero and John Carpenter have to show some restraint. They're simply.
You're filled with lightning when you hit the road. You're feeling that D6 power as you take control. Nothing can stop you now. You're moving on.
It's a chance. Okay. So, this up yours, the so-called impudent finger, mentioned already in ancient Roman writings. And it's quite consistent, this gesture, because it is difficult to miss the Christological resonances of this scene of the dying hero who saved the world. No longer than that, in a unique moment in the history of art, the dying Christ himself was portrayed in a similar way. In Michelangelo's unfinished drawing of Christ on the cross, which he first gave to his passionate, intimate friend Vittoria Colonna, and then inexplicably asked her to return it to him, it's a great mystery, the history of art. What is so terrible that he wanted it terribly bad? Okay, so the drawing renders the critical moment of Christ's doubt and despair, the moment of, Father, why have you forsaken me? For the first time, so art historians claim, in the history of painting, an artist tried to capture Christ's abandonment by God, Father. But the key detail is you have to focus on the right hand of Christ. There are no nails to be seen, but the hands, okay, not the middle finger, but the point finger is stretched out. A vulgar gesture which, according to Quintilian's Rhetorics of Gestures, which it can be proven was known to Michelangelo, functions as a sign of devil's rebellious challenge. And it's a nice different reading. Christ's why is not a resigned why, but an aggressive, accusatory one. There is in the drawing even an implicit tension between the expression of Christ's face, despair, suffering, and the mode signaled by his hand, rebellion, defiance, as if the hand articulates the attitude the face doesn't dare to express. And I don't have time. It would be nice to go here, for example, to the Fight Club. You remember that wonderful scene of Ed Norton beating himself in front of his boss, where also his hand disobeys him. His hand starts to beat him. So the lesson of Michelangelo is here a very precise one. One should abandon the notion of Christ as a model of self-erasing humility, modest self-abandonment, and surrender to the higher paternal authority. Father, let your will be done, and so on. We should rediscover a Christ who is strangely close to a fallen angel like Lucifer, a Christ of obstinate rebellion against the order of things, a Christ who is ready to persist on its own against all odds. This is the Christianity we need today. Thank you very much. Okay. Yeah. I stay here or? is propaganda. You heard Satie there.
We put on some Eric Satie for you. Can we have 1 minute of Satie again? Just a bit of subliminal propaganda in the library. You hear the propaganda. Slavo Žižek, comrade, you will take some questions now. We have a mic there.
Unfortunately, yes, we have to pretend that we are in democracy, and I'm always for a dialogue. But you know for what kind of dialogue, it's my old joke. Late Plato's dialogues, you know them. One guy talks all the time, the other guy says every 10 minutes, by Zeus, so it is. You are right, Socrates, and so on. So, yes, I'm ready for this kind of dialogue.
And the questions should be a little bit like the response, if I may ask that questions, in my view, last about 52 seconds. So ask them quickly, and you'll get a long answer.
I will try also to, I will try my best to do, that would be my ideal, when you get a difficult question, this kind of a Zen answers, you know, like you ask me a complex question, what did Lacan mean by this? I say, clap with one hand or something like that. Sorry, let's go on, please.
I was just wondering what you think the implications ideologically are for the fact that in the Gospels, when Christ says, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, God, why have you forsaken me? My father, why have you forsaken me? That's actually a quotation from a psalm which starts out that way as a voicing despair, but ends up being a hymn of affirmation.
I know.
And that's an allusion that would have been known to the readers at that time.
I know this fact.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what it... But the only... think is that I don't think, you know, in the way I deal with ideology, I don't think that one should not underestimate, but also one should not overestimate, I think, the sources. Because, you know, ideological struggle is violent. You take something, you make it to a totally different mode. The much more crucial comparison or parallel would have been, for me, the Book of Job. I repeat my point. If there is a text which deserves the title of the first critique of ideology, it's the Book of Job. You know why? We know what happens there. Job thinks, look, sad for him, blah, 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 everything destroyed. Then ideology enters, the three theological friends. Read it closely. What happens there is that each of the three friends offers an ideological justification for his catastrophe. The first one, it's a rather simple one. Like, God is just so. You must have done something wrong, even if you do not know why. What? The second one, slightly more refined version. Something like, this can be some kind of a God's trial, checking up how strong your faith is. So the point is that what they all try to convince Job is that his misfortunes has a meaning. And Job's protests are not about how, no, I was a good guy, I didn't do anything wrong. He just insists that, no, I don't buy it, that there is any meaning in these difficulties. And the beautiful point is that when God comes at the end, he says, you know, every word the three ideologists said is wrong. Everything that Job said is right. And also, my favorite theologist, Gilbert Hicks Chesterton, has a wonderful reading of that famous God's response, where God says, did you know what monsters I created, this, that? Usually this is read as God's absolute arrogance, like, who are you? I created horses, this, that, whatever. I read it like Chesterton, in a much more ambiguous way, that basically it's God despair. God is overwhelmed by his own creation. God's message is, you complain, but look, like you complain about your mess, but look, all creation is one big mess, and so on. Like, which is why I think it's crucial to read the death of Christ against the background of this, of Job. Christ is Job radicalized. In what sense? What dies on the cross is not, that's the big question. It's not a representative of God. It's not God is there, we are here, God sends a messenger, sorry, it looks bad, he returns. It's, as Hegel put it out, it's the God of beyond himself who dies. God as the big other, in what sense? I always hated this disgusting metaphor of religion as things look bad for us, but from a larger perspective, like God sees the true context. You know, I love this. Like once, with all my Palestinian sympathies, I heard Louis Farrakhan on a British radio. And he was asked, but you said Jewish religion is the religion of gutter, of pigs, no? And he said, no, no, this is not anti-Semitic. It sounds so because you have torn it out of context, no? Okay, I mean, yeah. I am absolutely sure that if Hitler were to be caught in the 50s, he would say, you should put my Holocaust in a proper context. So I think, you know, this disgusting metaphor, which is that of a painting, you know, you see an image from too close, you see a stain. When you see it from the proper perspective, you see that the stain contributes to the global harmony. But Christ's death means that this doesn't work. What we know today, like, isn't it obscene to say Gulag, Holocaust? It appears to us as a terrible stain, but from a proper context, it contributes, I don't know how, to divine harmony or whatever. I think that this dies with Christ. I read his death as literally the death of God. God resigns. I can no longer play that role of guaranteeing meaning. God throws himself into, as it were, his own creation. The message is, what comes after me? Holy Spirit. And you have a wonderful model of Holy Spirit. I wanted to do it, but it would take too much time. Do you know, now I appeal to your leftist memory. Do you know that wonderful, simplistic, popular, old leftist American song performed by Paul Robeson or in Woodstock by Joan Baez, Joe Hill? Did you notice how it's a very Christological song? The death organizer of Wobblies, Joe Hill, who was, a murder was planted on him, he was killed, appears to an ordinary worker, that's the story of the song, and the guy says, but Joe, you are dead, how can you be here? And then Joe Hill answers simply, it takes more than a gun to kill a man, what they, the bad guys, could never kill, it went on to organize itself. And then it's that simple message, where am I, whenever the two of you are together to organize a strike, I am there, all that stuff, which is for me exactly the same as when Jesus says, whenever two of you love each other, and agape is for me, the only correct translation of agape is political love. Whenever the two of you love yourself, I am there. So it's totally wrong to look for reincarnation like some idiot there arises. No, it's here, it's already here, reincarnation, in what we are doing without any guarantee in the big other. I think the way to read it is not, we do what we can, God will help us. No, we don't have to trust God, God has to rely on us. It's kind of a open historical perspective. It's God says, it's up to you. And again, if we read it against all this, then things get interested in Christianity. This is how I try to read it, this materialist reading of God renounces, and what happens is Holy Spirit, as to put it bluntly, I wouldn't say Communist Party, but an emancipatory collective. I think it's quite consequent reading. You don't need any, the big other is dead. There is no guarantee. So I think it's totally pagan, this reading of that somewhere up there is God. Or if some of you know theological topic, this reading that, which is why I disagree with Orthodox Russian Christianity. The main point of it is that you should distinguish divine economy, how God deals with the world, with God in itself, so that you have Trinity of God up there, already existing all the time. But I think this then, you totally lose the point. If Christ is all the time with God, then the fact that Christ came here and died means nothing. It was just a joke. The three of them were really all the time having nice time up there, and the point was, you go down and fake that you are dead so that we made a good impression on people. It was a kind of a PR. Okay, sorry, I was too long, but I hope I made some kind of point. I'm not sure what. Yeah.
Hey there. I noticed before you were a little dismissive about David Lynch's transcendental meditation thing. So I was kind of curious about that, but I'd read in some of your books, you talked about how you thought that kind of New Age Asiatic thought had become like a prevailing ideology for Western post-industrial capitalism. But I mean, don't you think that kind of esoteric practices, I mean, a lot of people feel that, you know, esoteric meditation, yogic, spiritual disciplines are something that the West kind of lost. And that's why kind of religion ended up in a kind of sterile form, that bringing those back actually has validity. And that also, if you look at transcendental meditation, they've done studies in, like, I think in a precinct in Washington, D.C., they had a set of meditators doing TM around the clock. The murder rate actually went down during that time. So it suggests that there might actually be some kind of tangible material benefit to spiritual disciplines and spiritual practices.
I know the story. I know how... The standard defense, even of radical critiques of religion, like Sam Harris, no, is that they take exception to Buddhist meditation, claiming this is not really about any superstitious thesis about supernatural beings. It's something which can be even dealt with in scientific terms. But, you know, first I doubt in the... Of course, you can always find some statistics, but I think I doubt if it's really about... How should I put it? I doubt if the crime rate went down. I doubt first if it was really the effect of meditation as such, or if it was first some pre-selection. What type of people have chosen to do it and some other thing? Because let me tell you, okay, I will not go too much into it, but with all my respect that I otherwise have for meditation, but... Transcendental meditation and so on, I don't think it does any better in social life, helping prevent crime, whatever you want. And again, I always quote the same story here, Brian Victoria Zen at War, which proves how not only the entire, literally with 5-6 exceptions, Zen Buddhist community in Japan in the 30s and 40s supported the Japanese war effort, but they even actively justified it precisely in the terms of Zen Buddhism. For example, the name well known to all of you, if you are unfortunately as old as I am already, Daisetsu Taitaro Suzuki, the great hippie name. What people don't like to hear is that in the 30s and early 40s, he was writing different types of texts. For example, when Japanese invaded China, he fully supported it, claiming the Chinese don't get it, that the sword which is killing him, that is really a sword of love. More precisely, he provided very precise advices how, if you achieve this, the inner peace of and distance of Zen meditation, how it's much easier to kill. He takes the example of how if you remain caught into your false self, then you perceive a situation like, sorry, I'm killing you. No, that's wrong, he said. You must pretend the attitude, I float in the air and observe how my sword is moving in the air and you got stuck on my sword. How should I put it? Don't take it personally.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, you know, and then he even went a step further. No, sorry, this is not Suzuki, let's be fair. Another priest who developed a whole theory of how for ordinary people who don't have time to spend years meditating, total unconditional military discipline is the best way to enlightenment, overcoming your false self and so on. So even then I read another very ironic text and some historian, I'm very sorry, but I'm not bluffing, went to analyze like what effectively changed in Far East countries where Buddhism took over, where Buddhists were the kings, where, how should I put it in slightly vulgar statistical terms, the average rate of killing, if anything, went up, not down. So I doubt about that. But again, I'm not saying we are any better. I'm just totally pessimist here. I think the tragic thing to accept is that the authenticity of our, whatever we call it, inner enlightenment, inner truth, or
inner peace doesn't help, it's ethically neutral. And what I really appreciate in Suzuki, now let me avoid a misunderstanding. I'm not saying Suzuki pretended to be a Buddhist meditator. In reality, he was a cheap war propagandist. No, he was very good and very honest. In one of his books, people don't like to read it. He says, meditation is a technique. You can be, he says, a communist, a fascist, a liberal, whatever you want, it doesn't matter. That's what we should hear from it. So again, to answer you, I think it's deeply ambiguous because, you know, when you say it's less killing, it is less killing, but there is always an opening to say it's not so much that they are less killing in reality, but the killing itself is no longer experienced as traumatic killing. It just neutralizes it. You know, like, you know that terrible lines in Mahabharata, or where, you know where, Arjuna confronts God, what can I do, should I go into battle, and the God tells him, what you see is reality, is just a false reality, so the true I cannot be destroyed, so go on and kill, and so on. In other words, go on nicely killing, but with a proper distance, it doesn't matter. You must always be aware. Sorry, don't take it personally. If I kill you, I'm just killing a false material appearance, and so on and so on. You know, things are very ambiguous here. Sorry, I speak too much. Please strike back.
You know, thesis to condemn all philosophy because Heidegger was part of the Nazi Party, right? I mean, you could condemn spiritual practice because certain people used it to justify killing. But also, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita, which you're talking about, that Krishna says that for a warrior, if your dharma is to fight against evil, then you should make a war against evil. So and then it's a question of attaining a selfless perspective so you can, you know, act properly through your dharma. You know?
No, I see. Okay. This is now getting too much, but to ask your, sorry, what was your first point to that one I want to ask?
Well, just that you're saying, okay, well, because, you know, inner peace is not important because, I'm reducing what you just said.
Yeah.
Inner peace is not that important because if you look at D.T. Suzuki and Zen Buddhism, that could be used as an ideological support for militarism.
Yeah.
And I would say, well, then you could dismiss all philosophy because Heidegger was a Nazi.
I don't think that all philosophy is about inner peace, and my example would precisely be Heidegger here. In my new book, sorry for propaganda, which will be out in about 1 month, defense. I have a chapter which, okay, it's a bad joke, but then I immediately correct it. Like, the title of the chapter is Why Did Heidegger Do the Right Step in 1933? But then there is a footnote, although unfortunately in the wrong direction. No, like, my point is, it was right for him to risk the engagement, just like he chose the wrong side. But what I'm saying is that, no, it's not what, how should I put it? My God, I accept the results of Buddhist meditations and so on. What I'm saying is just repeating Suzuki. It's no help to fight evil or whatever. This is what I categorically deny. It doesn't guarantee any honesty or whatever, which is why it's way too simple to say, if Suzuki supported Japanese war efforts, it must have been something wrong in his philosophy. But on the other hand, I think that the majority of modern philosophy of subjectivity is definitely not about inner peace. And here I, nonetheless, in a problematic way, I don't know, remain faithful to, in a materialist way, of course, what interests me is the attitude to what bombastically we call Judeo-Christian legacy. And Chesterton has a nice line when he writes, what's the difference? The difference is that in other pagan religions, God is inside, in the sense of you turn to your true self and discover the ultimate identity between your true self and God. The fundamental fact of Judaism, which also goes on in Christianity, is that God is outside. The Jewish experience of God is not you look deep into yourself. It's some stupid bush burns there, whatever. I mean, now you are between two. No, Clinton was between two bushes. I always like this joke. Sorry, but you know what I mean? It's an irreducible alterity, and this is, I think, even the Christian solution is that you don't become like God. You identify with Christ on the cross, which is the point where God becomes split in itself, When you are abandoned by God, you say, but wait a minute. Now I'm in a position of Christ where God was abandoned by itself. It's a radically different existential position. It's not the position of I am one with universe when I... This is this non-Judeo-Islam, I even include Islam here, non-Judeo-Islamic Christian position is... Deep into yourself, you discover, as it were, the ultimate identity between your ego and universe when you cleanse yourself of your false particular attachments, whatever. I think that Judeo-Christian Islamic universe is totally different. It's not inner peace, it's radical engagement. It's different. It's almost the opposite, I would say. What for traditional religions is sin, engagement, partiality, and so on. That's what I appreciate as a materialist, leftist in Christianity. Truth is not neutral. Truth is in the engagement. Okay, maybe I simplify it here, but I simplify it here, I hope not so much in my books. If this will in any way amuse you, I am now finishing a book engaged in a big debate with that radical orthodoxy big guy, John Milbank. I wrote 200 pages, he wrote 250 pages. I found this personal attack that somebody dares to write more than me. I am now replying 150 pages, where we do go through all these topics in detail. Again, to repeat my point, I am not saying Oriental meditation is false and so on. I'm just repeating what they themselves are saying. It's neutral. It's neutral. I think it's totally false to This is even as some of my, a Japanese friend of mine told me something very beautiful. He told me all this dream that Oriental spiritual brings peace, balance in the world. This is your Western misreading. These false hopes projected into Oriental spirituality, this is the true Western cultural imperialism, if you look for it. Sorry, I was too long.
So I would say, based on how long the next response is, we'll take one or two questions.
You have your natural evil, no?
I do.
Good that you confess. That's the first step towards redemption. Sorry.
Enlightenment.
Sorry.
The place of the virtual in your work has changed over the last probably 10 years and become increasingly important. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the relationship between that and ideology, which was what you were talking about tonight. I know that's huge, so... to specify a little more, if there's a way to talk about it in terms of, do you see the virtual as adding anything to Lacan's theory, or is it just another way of explaining things that are already there?
Very good question. Obviously, you, as we put it, you know your job. You read the stuff. No, it is. Why is it a good question? Because I think that I just mirrored in my more modest work, a big shift in Lacan. Of course, we are talking here about Lacanian notion of the real. The standard notion of the real, which is unfortunately still predominant and identified with Lacan, is that real, it's the real thing, too traumatic, too strong, you know, like sun, you cannot look it eye to eye, whatever, the harsh reality, and then all the symbolic texture as a protection, like real is too strong to confront it. But later for Lacan, real becomes virtual. In the sense that the true real is not the harsh thing you see there. The true real is precisely a non-existing, not fully existing, virtual absent point of reference. Real becomes virtual. As to ideology here, yes, it did change my critique of ideology, and I will tell you where. It's just a very detailed move, but it's an important shift. For a long time, till a couple of years ago, I still participated in this leftist paranoiac distrust of this material texture of ideology. I was, with all my respect for her, to avoid misunderstanding, I was all too much into Susan Sontag trap. You know Susan Sontag's reading, for example, of Leni Riefenstahl, no? Like, since she was a Nazi for those 10 years then, you have to look before and after, already in her early Mountain films, it's all the same, up to her late photos and so on. Well, first, there are many empirical reasons to doubt this, like her last Das Blaue Licht, the Blue Light mountain film. You know, there is a slight problem. Her lover at that time was all for a Nazi, the worst combination possible, a Jew and a Marxist, Bela Balázs, the cinema theorist. He co-wrote the scenario with her. So you can also give, and some of my friends are trying to do it, to read that film as much more ambiguous, almost leftist. It's a girl, I don't know how she's called, alone in the mountain, outcast, and so on. It can be... So I don't buy this idea of proto-fascism, you know, like, oh, then it must be already before, and so on. So to give you... And I think that precisely we should not be afraid to liberate those elements. And I will conclude with two examples which I was tempted to use. We don't have time. The one is Cabaret. Do you have a friend whom you suspect is he truly intellectual or not? Show him from Cabaret. You remember when they are in a countryside, the heroes, they visit, stay for lunch at a small inn, local restaurant, and then a young boy starts to sing a song, Awake tomorrow belongs to me, and so on. And then if your friend says, oh my God, how this engages people, now I understand what is fascism, the friend is half intellectual. I think that the first, what is fascist about that song? Nothing. I claim that if a communist were to sing that song and say, tomorrow a sign is red star and so on, tomorrow belongs to us, I totally buy that song. You know what I mean? I don't think ideology is in this mini texture. This mini texture is what Alain Badiou calls this stupid multitude of jouissances. And now I give you a positive example. I don't know how well known they are here in the States, that German punk hard rock band called Rammstein. You know, this hard music, using music, bombing you, all the Nazi imagery and so on. Okay, the liberal attitude is, it's dangerous, they are playing with fire. What if, and this is typical liberal patronizing, what if we all know that it's irony, ironic imitation, but what if there are some young people who will take it too literally and become Nazis or whatever? I think it's totally wrong. You know what Rammstein does? Let me give you an example that I like. I will be brief. Don't be too much in a panic. I see a panic in your gaze. 20 years ago, north of my own country, Slovenia, in Austria, there was a nationalist, right-wing, populist hatred towards Slovenes exploded as if we are some kind of a threat and wanted to reoccupy whatever, which is ridiculous. We are a small nation, nobody. That part, Carinthia, Kärnten. And their formula was, in German, Kärnten bleibt Deutsch. Like, Carinthia will remain German. And what did the Austrian leftists do? Something very intelligent. Not any critico-ideological analysis, blah, blah, blah. They just published in main newspapers a paid ad with taking this formula and just then proposing obscene variations, like Kärnten bleibt Deutsch. This is correct German. Carinthia remains German. Kärnten bleibt Deutsch. Kärnten bleibt Bleutsch. Kärnten bleibt Bleutsch, and so on. And it was an extraordinary obscenization, you know. Suddenly the charm was lost. What was a nice political motto became a dirty obscenity. I think that this is what bands like Rammstein are doing with Nazi ideology. So if you are love this kind of a heart music which mobilizes all the Nazi symbols, don't be afraid. Fully identify with it, enjoy it. This is how you will undermine Nazism.
So. Well, thank you very much for tonight.
I thank you.
I would like to, before we give a full applause to Slavoj Žižek, I would like to say that he is not signing his book that is about to appear. That will be the next time you come here. He's signing other books that have appeared, quite a few. And your story about, you know, that you wanted to tell us two stories reminds me of...
Sorry, which story?
At the very end, you said, I want to tell you two stories, and you were afraid that I was getting very nervous. It reminded me of that wonderful line of Woody Allen, who said, you know, I'd love to leave you with something positive. Will you accept two negatives? But I...
Yeah.
I'm also reminded...
We call this dialectics.
I'm also reminded of Kafka being quite humorous. You know that line of Kafka where he says there's hope, but not for us. So thank you very much for tonight.
Thank you.